Support for WPR comes from The Alliance, committed to being an objective partner for over 425 employers and their brokers, providing self-funded employers with data to manage their health plans. The-Alliance.org.
Support for WPR comes from Luther College in Decorah, Iowa. With summer camps for pre-K through high school, offering skills in sports, music, and more. luther.edu/summer-camps.
Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hello, I'm Larry Mueller, and today we welcome Melinda Myers back to the microphone. She is an award-winning gardening expert. She's a certified arborist. She's a TV host, author. What am I missing?
And a gardener, most and importantly.
Well, you know, I think the last time you were on, we mentioned that you were receiving the 2007 Perennial Plant Association Gardening Media Award. That's in Columbus, Ohio.
Right. They're celebrating their anniversary of the organization, and Columbus happens to be my hometown. So it's
a double.
Right. So it's a good excuse to go home and visit, make a quick trip home and visit with wonderful perennial plant experts from around the world and visit my family. So it's kind of a double benefit for me.
Do you get to give a little talk to while you're there?
I just get to say thank you, which is enough for me to say.
That's all right. That's kind of nice, too.
It is. It is. Exactly.
Well, how's your garden growing?
It's doing well. Like everybody, the thistles have been thriving. Mm-hmm. And so keeping up with the weeds is always a challenge. And I think one of the big things that I want to encourage people to do is keep planting. You know, often we put our plants in Memorial Day or early June, and then we're done. But often with the growing season in Wisconsin being so changeable, or in the upper Midwest, that things don't always turn out the way we want, or maybe a few perennials faded, or, you know, you hit sometimes that time in your garden where you go, wow, it just isn't got the pizzazz I want.
Right.
And so I'm still popping in annuals in some of those areas in my garden, and garden centers are doing a great job now of providing good size annuals that you can either pop into vacant spaces in your garden or put them in containers. You know, you have a special party, and I love to have cut flowers, but I also love to pot up some plants and use those as my centerpiece. And then when the party's over, you still have plants to enjoy or give them away to your guest as well.
We had guests from Wisconsin Public Radio visiting here recently, and so we had picked up some perennials and some annual plants and stuck them in pots, and it was great.
It does. It really, it kind of just sets your garden off that much more and just makes it look a little nicer.
Well, I tell you what, we have callers online to visit with you. And let me give the number, by the way, if you'd like to join in with your question. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Or if you're in Madison, reach us at 263-1890. And you can email us at talk@wpr.org. And Rick in Eau Claire is on. So let's go to Rick. Hi, Rick.
How you doing?
Good. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Rick.
I did a complete replanting of a front yard. We have a retaining wall.
Okay.
We actually have two retaining walls with fairly sandy soil that they use for backfill. Now, I planted close to 120 perennials in there.
Wow.
And the only ones that are not doing well are my Asiatic lilies and my black-eyed Susans. My Asiatic lilies look like they're being eaten from the ground up, and that's maybe two of the plants, and then the other three are browning out very quickly.
Damn.
Okay. Asiatic lilies are a favorite for deer and rabbits. So if you literally are seeing things eaten, that's a possibility. There are some beetles that will eat holes in the leaves as well. But I'll tell you, lilies are like candy to deer and rabbits. And if you've got that problem in your area, that's the first thing they're going after. Lilies like well-drained soils, but they like it moist. And you bring up a good point about the sandy soil. So you might want to check your moisture. Mm-hmm. When things brown, it can be too much or not enough water. And I'm guessing with your sandy soil, that may be an issue.
I got about 4 inches of cypress mulch on top.
Okay.
And I keep it fairly well watered. Once a day, I'll give them a really good drink, but, you know, it dries out so fast.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
I could put a water, you know, slow drip water on it, and I could come back 6 hours later and it'd barely be moist.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, and I can feel your frustration and pain. And those of us with heavy clay soil are going, we just want a little bit of that drainage. Mm-hmm. Here's what you may want to try to do, a couple things. under your mulch, and I know you've mulched it in really good, one of my concerns with using any kind of wood mulch on perennials, annuals, and vegetables is it breaks down slowly. So from the person that's laying the mulch, that's a good thing. It's like, yay, I don't have to come back next year and do it. But on the downside is it's not breaking down, adding organic matter to improve the soil beneath. And organic matter is going to help your sandy soil hold the moisture longer. So as your garden grows and develops, and it will, you know, considering you put 120 in and you're only having problems with those two.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, it's really good. I know not for you, but it really is very good. But adding shredded leaves or using that kind of mulch, even under your cypress mulch, some landscapers are doing some, especially those doing sustainable landscaping, are putting shredded leaves and then their wood chips over top of it. And that way the leaves break down, add organic matter more quickly. Nitrogen deficiencies, it doesn't sound like you're having, but typically you get yellowing, stunting, and then browning of your plants. And that can be an issue. I would just kind of keep monitoring the moisture, check for deer and rabbits. It may be one of those things that your lilies are an addition you make in a few years after your soil organic matter is built up and it holds the moisture better, or find some areas that tend to hold moisture better. For the black-eyed Susan, are the leaves getting black spots and then turning brown and dying out?
There's a couple times that I've come home, you know, when we had the upper 80s, lower 90s. I've come home, you know, and they've been wilted over a little bit. And I water them, they spring right back.
Okay.
But with the sandy soil, I try and, you know, I try and fertilize them about once, about once a week, maybe once every 10 days or so.
Okay, well, a couple things you may want to do. One of the things is, and I know with sandy soil and you're watering thoroughly and it's drying out, and since it's a new garden, you know, you need to keep that soil slightly moist. Eventually, you want to go to every other day and thoroughly water, and then every third day, because then what you do is you're training the roots to go deep. When we water every day, you're really keeping those roots near the soil surface. So if you gradually go every other day, and I know it's hard to do because they're very wilted. My mom planted Nicotiana on my recommendation one time in front of their house, and she goes, boy, these things have to be watered every day. And I'm like, no, Mom, they don't. And she'd go out at 4:30. They'd be a little wilted to conserve moisture. And I said, just go to the other side of the yard. Come back at 7 when the sun's a little less intense. And sure enough, they were perked up and looking better. So you may want to try, you know, avoiding that. Give them a chance. If they're still wilted, you know, when the temperatures start dropping and the sun's not as intense, then you know they definitely need to be watered. But often plants wilt to conserve moisture. So again, try to keep that mulch. That's great. Adding organic matter throughout, you know, the years to come is going to help. And then gradually break that watering every other day, every third day, you know, to eventually twice a week, a good soaking should do it for you. So the lilies, I wouldn't give up on them, but I probably wouldn't add more until you get that soil in good shape.
Good luck. Thanks, Rick, for calling very much. Appreciate it. Barb in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Barb.
Hi.
Hi, Barb.
I have sort of a strange problem going on in my yard. Very different species of plants. The ends of the branches are, like, shriveling up. The leaves are small, and they're not exactly dry, but they're misformed and very just kind of wrinkled. And I'm talking about a nectarine and an apple and a cherry and goldenrod and garden phlox. So it's not like it's just one species. And I've looked at them. I can't seem to find any bugs. I'm not quite sure what it might be.
Okay. My first guess was going to be aphids, because I've been seeing a lot of aphid damage in the area. In fact, my apple tree in my front yard, you have to walk by it a couple times before you take a close look, and the leaves were yellow and kind of curled, and I was worried about fire blight. Took a closer look, and sure enough, here were some aphids. Now, what I typically saw were a lot of the cast exoskeletons that were kind of brown and you know, kind of a gritty feel. I'm seeing a lot of sticky honeydew on my windshield, which means there's a lot of aphids out there on the maples as well as a variety of plants. So one of the things you may want to do, especially depending on when you go, we had a couple very spotty showers last night and the night before. That helps dislodge some of them. You might want to check just check the leaves again. Get out a hand lens to make sure that you're not missing something. It's so easy to miss those. But aphids are one of the things that I'm seeing some problems with. Powdery mildew arrived early this year, but typically, you know, it sounds like if you've grown phlox, you know what powdery mildew is.
Yeah.
And, you know, you typically get that white powdery substance, then the yellowing, then the browning and the distorted look. Mites can also cause the same kind of damage, and they're harder to see than aphids. You really do need a hand lens to see those, and they'll attack a variety of plants. So one is I would, you know, try to get a hand lens out and take a close look at the leaves. Second, a strong blast of water will dislodge aphids and mites, and often that's enough. And if you feel that you do find them, insecticidal soap is a really good option, or neem, N as in Nancy, E-E-M as in Mary, which is a plant-derived material that will kill soft-bodied insects like mites and aphids. And when you're talking a variety of plants, I really hate to get out the pesticides unless I really feel there's a need for it, especially with our concerns with honeybees. So that's why soap is a good option. You have to repeat the applications, but it's going to be a lot safer for the good guys in the garden. So I would take another closer look at it. If it continues, let's hope it doesn't continue through State Fair, but bring your baggies to see me when you come to State Fair and we'll take a close look together.
Are the branches on your bushes, are they kind of going one branch at a time, or are they?
No, it's the tips of every
single. It's the tips,
single,
okay.
It's just
all right,
the tips
I was thinking maybe
of every single branch on the trees. Every single one is
okay.
Just sort of shriveling.
Just the tips, okay.
Which
just like the end four or five leaves.
Yeah, and that's what makes me think mites and aphids.
Yeah.
Larry's right. If it's a branch at a time, verticillium will attack a variety of plants. The good news is it doesn't sound like that because that's really bad.
That's really bad.
So let's hope that it's aphids or mites. You know what? Just get a strong blast of water. Take out early in the morning. Just hose off your plants. A really good knock, you know, knock those tips off, the, you know, moisten those tips. And then if you feel the need, follow up with insecticidal soap. Hopefully we'll get some rains, and that's going to really help us with both those insect populations.
Thanks, Barb.
Okay, thank you.
Kathy in Racine, your turn now. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. I just have a couple quick questions regarding mulching. I unfortunately had to sort of ignore my landscaping last summer, and I'm feeling the pain now with tons and tons of weeds, and I'm slowly getting at them, and once I'm finished, I know I have to remulch. The question regarding the mulch is, number one, how thick? And number two, I need a mulch that's safe for my two golden retrievers who love to chew.
Great. Mm-hmm. Well, and I'm glad you brought that up. We'll start with some general guidelines, but before I forget, you don't want it. Do not use cocoa bean shell mulch.
I know that.
And I thought I would share that with others because I figured you must if you're telling me you have dogs, because dogs love chocolate. It can kill some, and some vets have reported doing autopsies and finding a gut full of cocoa bean shells. So don't use cocoa bean shells if you have dogs. So thank you for bringing that up so I didn't forget to mention it. In general, the finer the material, the thinner the layer of mulch. So like, you know, evergreen needles or shredded leaves, those fine materials, you only need 1 to 2 inches. Now, the downside, the good part is they break down quickly. They add organic matter nutrients to the soil, so you'll be replenishing them every year, but you'll only need a fine layer. Shredded bark, wood chip, thicker things, a 2 to 3 inch layer is really sufficient. Now, if you're doing mulch around perennials and annuals, you may want to add some supplemental nitrogen if you are using a wood mulch. Wood chip mulches break down slowly, and they temporarily tie up the nitrogen in the soil.
Right.
And then once they break down, they put that nitrogen back. But short term, sometimes with the smaller rooted plants like annuals, vegetables, annual flowers, and even some younger perennials, you may see some stunting yellowing. So a little bit of a slow release, low nitrogen fertilizer at the time of mulching will help compensate for that.
Makes sense.
Yeah, and one of the other things is to look in your community. One of my favorite mulches is composted leaves. Municipality near me, you can go get them for free. They want to get rid of them. They've been decomposing a couple years, so they're still pretty substantial, and they look just like soil. So when I dig and move and pull weeds, you know, it doesn't look like I've been in there. And I'm not a neat, tidy garden, but you know, when you have wood chip mulch and you dig a hole, you always have soil on top of it, and it looks messy. And then you worry about the wood going in the soil. So if you can find composted leaves or save your own and shred them with the mower, or if you've got a source for evergreen needles, those those work wonderful.
And shredding is important, by the way?
Well, shredding just, they don't mat down as readily. I have year-old leaves that that aren't really shredded, so they're broken down enough. They just kind of lay easier, and I think it's easier to work them around, and they break down faster. So one thing in the fall when you're thinking about next season is start collecting leaves from your neighborhood or even from your own yard, stockpiling them, bag them up, tuck them under your evergreens by the foundation of your house out of sight, added insulation, and then you have them when you're ready to use them next season.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Great.
Okay, good All right. luck with that.
Thank you very much.
Yep. Thanks, Kathy, for calling. Appreciate your call. And Wayne in Green Bay, you're next. Hi, Wayne.
Good morning.
Hi,
morning.
Wayne.
I have two questions this morning. One is about iris rhizome borer.
Okay.
I'm thinking about digging them up. Is that a good idea to do it now? And what, how would I treat them then?
One
trying
of the,
to save them.
Okay. And just kind of a general rule of thumb with iris is we like at least 6 to 8 weeks after blooming before we dig and divide them. So usually for most of the earlier blooming ones, the middle of July is where we're getting to. The heat and the drought, though, is sometimes an issue. And so I like to wait, you know, if it seems like it's going to be a really hot spell, you know, even going into August or September. But if you do have the borer, that is one way to take care of them. So 6 to 8 weeks after blooming, that gives them time to put energy back, lift up those rhizomes, cut out any of the damaged rhizomes, kill any borers that you find. If you don't see borers late, if you do dividing later and you don't see the borers but you see damage, they've probably pupated. And that's more in the August time frame. Flood that area. The pupa often float to the surface, little cocoons, and then you can collect them and smash them. You can replant in the same area because the adult is the one that lays the eggs, and it flies around. It's a moth, and it flies around and lays its eggs on leaf litter in the fall. So cleanup in the fall is a great way to reduce the problem. And then, so replanting in the same spot doesn't mean you're going to have iris borer any more than if you move them 10 feet away, because that adult moth is going to find them. So clean up in the fall, get rid of them as you find them, as you dig and divide. So that's a very good idea. And I like to get my rhizomes, my irises planted in September if possible, by early October, just so they get established before winter, because they're so close to the surface. So as long as you can water them and you've got them in a good spot, 6 to 8 weeks after bloom, you're in good shape.
Okay. And the question I have on tulips, I had about half of them didn't come up. Over 200 tulips didn't come up this year. And so I did some digging around, and really puny little bulbs were there where they were, and a lot of the others that came up were just leaves, and really didn't get any blossoms. So I never had that before. I reordered, so I'm going to have a bunch of new ones next year. But do you have any idea what might have caused that?
Well, a couple of things. Many of the new hybrid tulips are bred to give us a great show the first season and not so much the second and third. So it's very disappointing when you spend extra money for that really beautiful tulip and you don't always get the good show. The second thing is hot summers can be a problem because tulips, when you read the directions, they plant them 8 inches deep. Being in the north, we think it's about insulating from the cold, and that's part of it. But the other part's insulating it from the heat. So if they get too warm, sometimes they won't flower reliably for you, and the bulb size will tend to decline. So mulching in the summer, just to keep that area cooler, or interplanting them with your perennials, looking for, and you've already ordered, so I'm sure you've made some good choices, but perennializing or species tulips are also going to give you a longer lasting show, meaning more years, maybe not the knock your socks off bloom, but they'll be back year after year. And the other thing I found, it doesn't sound like the case for you, Wayne, and very smart that you dug up to see what's going on, because sometimes the bulbs disappear because animals eat them and move them. Sometimes they rot. And this year, we had some problems with those warm spells, things getting started. The flower buds weren't obvious to us, but they were above ground, and some of them got nipped by the cold. And so they produced leaves and no blooms. So you might have had a couple of things going on, and most of which are out of your control. So, you know, it sounds like you obviously know how to plant your tulips right. Let's hope for some good weather to cooperate and the squirrels to go somewhere else.
Absolutely. Wayne, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Melinda Meyer is our guest, certified arborist, gardening expert, TV host, and author. I'm Larry Mueller. Karen Prager, our on-air producer on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Net. Larry Mueller with my guest, Melinda Myers. Thanks for listening. Give us a call if you have a question at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. Let's go to Rosemary in Greenfield. Hi, Rosemary.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Actually, I have two questions. My first original one was I have two carpet roses bushes, and the bottom layer that was blooming beautifully until yesterday, and now a whole bunch of them have turned brown. Should I cut off each little blossom, or can I cut back on the stem a little bit?
Great question. This is the time of year where people are trying to figure out, what do I do with my roses? So I'm so glad you asked, Rosemary. The flower carpet rose really forms a nice cluster of small.
They're beautiful.
Aren't they great? I have one in my backyard, too. And to get the longest benefit of the bloom, we do pick off the ones individually and then take, once the whole cluster's bloomed out, prune back to the first or second five-leaflet leaf on the stem.
Yes, I always learned that, the five-leaf.
Right. Now, you can do a shortcut, and I have to confess, I have a flower carpet rose, and I do very little deadheading. When the little girls in the neighborhood want to take flowers home, that's about the time. I don't even deadhead. They're nice, you know, buds. So I do minimal deadheading, and mine blooms all summer long, which is great.
But these are sort of large clusters.
Right, exactly.
So I just take off the whole cluster?
You can once it's bloomed out, or if you're like, well, three-fourths of it's bloomed out, and I don't want to putz around with taking the individual flowers. If you take the individual blooms, you're going to get a neater and tidier look for a longer period. But, you know, what you can do is just go, I think I'll take these off to encourage new growth to come.
Well, if I cut each little bloom off, will they re-bloom again?
Well, then when you're done with all the individual blooms, then you take the whole cluster off.
I see. Just so you take off the whole cluster.
Right, when it's all bloomed out. So you do the individual ones as they fade, if you want to keep it neat and tidy and extend that the beauty. And then once that's all bloomed out, then you take the whole stem back. And the reason we go back, just, you probably know this, Rosemary, but for others listening, the reason we go back to the first five-leaflet leaf at least is so that the new growth is nice and stiff and sturdy. If we don't, we get this fine twiggy growth that can't support the flowers, isn't as tough and winter hardy. So pruning deep, as hard as it is sometimes for gardeners to do, is better for your plant.
Yes, I learned about that five-leaf business about 50 years ago.
Okay, so you're a pro at that. You have to help me spread the word.
My other question is, I have two beautiful hydrangeas, and I had put the aluminum sulfate on about 10 days ago, and they were just, they turned blue, and they were just gorgeous until this morning. And I'm looking right at them, and now half of them have turned pinkish.
Pinkish, yep.
Yeah, unfortunately, we have high pH soils in southern Wisconsin, especially in the Greenfield, Milwaukee area. Our pHs are very high. And what happens is we have plenty of aluminum in the soil, but it's not available to the plant. It's tied up in the soil. So we use aluminum sulfate, like you did, to add aluminum. But then what happens is eventually what the plant doesn't use is tied up in the soil. So you have to do repeat applications, usually once a month. But I'm thinking with the heat, and you're probably watering them frequently to keep them looking.
Every day I water because they just get...
droop, don't they?
Yeah, the little heads just go over.
Exactly. And so you're washing a lot of that out. Now, how old are your plants?
About, this is the third season.
Are they, they're in the ground, right?
Yes.
Okay. One of the things that I know it's so hard to do when they droop is just like I told the, I think it was Randy, Rick that called initially is, you know, start backing off in the water. A good soaking, and I know it's going to kill you, but try to go every other day. And then...
Well, that's what I was trying to do. Now, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, I thought.
Okay, great. And then, you know, it's kind of one of those, just turn a blind eye until the temperatures, you know, the sun goes down a bit. And if they don't perk up, then you definitely need to go back into more frequent watering. I would add some more aluminum sulfate. Usually it's once a month. The easiest thing is to embrace that pink color and go, wow, I wanted pink hydrangeas, not blue ones. So they're very tough to keep blue in alkaline soil.
Well, I put the sulfate on last week, just about a week ago today.
Yeah. I would be a little nervous about doing it. I'd give it at least another couple weeks, even though they're going to be pink for you, just with the heat and the moisture issues. Usually not a problem with aluminum sulfate, but we are worried about aluminum toxicity over time. So, you know, if you can give it a couple more weeks before you give them another shot, and just realize it's going to be a constant ongoing battle to try to keep those blue.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling, Rosemary. Appreciate your call. And Michael in River Falls, I think it's your turn. Hi, Michael.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. Thank you for calling.
I have a couple of questions. Recently, I have built some planter boxes with 5-foot trellis behind it, and I'm looking for some fast-growing something to cover those trellises.
Now, so these are these raised beds, or
they
these
are raised.
Container? Are these self-contained planting boxes, or are they attached to the ground and just raised beds?
They're attached to the ground with no bottoms.
Okay, in sun or shade?
Shade always.
Okay, are you growing anything other plants in that area? Any kind of annuals or perennials, and how are they doing?
No, not yet. We have planted a couple of ferns in front of it just for looks, but nothing yet. It's a blank canvas, and we're starting.
Okay, excellent. Well, with the trellises, my favorite shade vine really needs a brick background. So for other people looking for shade vines, it won't help you, but I do have some recommendations for you, Michael, so don't give up on me, is a climbing hydrangea. But it really likes a rough surface like mortar and brick to hang on to, and it takes really heavy shade, blooms about the middle of June, flowers like regular hydrangeas, nice yellow fall color, a beautiful but a slow grower. So for two reasons, not good for you. Honeysuckle, I've had luck pushing them into shade. The downside is more problems with powdery mildew. So that's why I was asking what else was growing to see just how much light. Sometimes we think we have heavy shade, but we have bright enough light for them to do well. One plant that does great in heavy shade is a plant called five-leaf akebia, A-K-E, B as in boy, I-A. It has leaves like a Schefflera, an indoor house plant, the Schefflera. Mm. It produces like dark rosy red, fragrant flowers, but very early, like April. So it's not going to knock your socks off, but it's one of those, for me, I have one on my back fence, and it's really nice because I'm so starved for flowers by then, I think all of us are, that even these finer, you know, very subtle looks are pretty. But the foliage is beautiful, and I always laugh because when I'm standing by it, I always joke that if you keep your lawn chairs close by, it'll be engulfed by this vine very quickly. So it'll give you quick cover, not a lot of foliage display. So that's one of the downsides of it. You may want to combine an annual vine with your perennial vine so you get some quick cover. I've had good luck with sweet autumn clematis, typically a sun lover, but if you've got, you know, bright light throughout, on and off throughout the day, that's what mine gets, and it blooms profusely in late summer, fall, wonderful white fragrant flowers. You know, if it's heavy shade all day, it's not going to do well for you. But if you've got some bright light throughout, it's one of the clematis I find do well almost anywhere. Obviously, full sun is its best. So those might be some things to try. But the five-leaf akebia is going to do great. Arctic Beauty Kiwi, that produces some small fruit, if you get a female as well, has green leaves with a blotch of pink and a cream edge. In heavy shade, you're going to see more green than the colorful foliage. Blooms, kind of subtle. You know, typically when we do shade plants, we don't see quite the knock your socks off. And the last one is Dutchman's Pipe, an old-fashioned favorite. Yeah. You know, when I think of Dutchman's Pipe, I think of old homes and small towns and use these as screen. The flowers are very subtle. You have to look under the leaves to see them. They're not like the big tropical pipes, but they're small, about an inch in diameter. Big heart-shaped leaves will give you nice foliage as well. So that might be another one to try.
I can grow those in combination with each other?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Sure. So you might want to try, you know, and that's a great idea. A couple of mixes of those to do well. There's a Meteor, I think it's called Meteor, Virginia creeper, very, very rambunctious, I would say. And it will take some shade, too, and it has variegated foliage. And in a contained environment might be the best place for that one, too.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then my other question is, I grew up in Northern California, and a neighbor had wisteria.
Oh, yeah.
I have heard that there are some varieties that will grow here, but I'm not sure about them.
Yeah, the Kentucky wisterias are hardy here. They're not like the ones you grew up with that we all just drool over. The Japanese and Chinese will survive plant-wise, but the flower buds aren't hardy, so you get all leaves and no flowers. The Kentucky wisteria, and there's many new cultivars out on the market. In fact, Monrovia has a new one called Blue Moon. Nice, fragrant blue flowers, about a foot long. I think it's Ant D is another one that's pretty readily available. And they need full sun, so not good for your shade area, and you need patience. It takes 5 to 7 years for them to get to a flowering stage. Okay. So, you know, it's one of those you put in and you just know you got to wait for a while.
Good luck, Michael.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. And Brenda. in Menasha. You're next. Hi, Brenda.
Hi. Is there a mulch that I could put on potted plants so I don't have to water them every day? And if I'm gone for a day or two, I don't have to worry about them?
You know, mulch is a great idea. And a lot of times we don't think about it for containers. Now, if you don't have dogs, the nice part about cocoa bean shell mulch is it's nice and small and fine. Shredded leaves I use on my containers as well, because and the benefit of the shredding then is it fits easier around the plant in that pot. And evergreen needles work great too. Now, in terms of watering, you know, some of the things are using self-watering containers if you travel a lot. Bigger containers dry out less frequently. So the bigger the pot, you can more readily get by with every other day for watering. Some gardeners like those soil moisture-holding polymers that hold moisture. For me, I choose not to use them. Some people swear by them, some swear at them, but they hold the moisture a little longer, and your potting mix has a great influence. So, yes, mulching is definitely a good idea. Grouping your plants together so as one transpires, the others benefit from that added humidity around the plant. And if I'm traveling and I have a friend, wonderful friend, who waters my containers when she feeds my cats. Well, cats get by every other day, so my planters have to get by every other day. So I just kind of push them all together in a somewhat shaded area when I'm traveling, and then that way she can give them a good thorough watering, you know, when she comes to feed the cats, and kind of keeps us good friends, and she keeps coming back to take care of them.
Okay,
so thanks for bringing that up. Good idea.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And you can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890, 263-1890. Speaking of watering, should we be watering in the morning or the evening? We usually water in the morning, early morning.
If you can water in the early morning, it's the best. You lose less moisture to evaporation. Uh-huh. You don't get the leaves wet so that you have wet leaves at night, which increases disease problems. And some gardeners go, well, when it rains at night. And I'm like, well, yeah, but we don't need to add to that problem.
Right.
And so you get more efficient use. And we've talked a little bit about watering thoroughly and less frequently, because that's going to encourage good deep root growth. One of the things I'm doing this year is I'll be at State Fair again, as usual, speaking twice a day at We Energy Energy Park, and I'm going to talk about sustainable landscaping, and watering is part of that, because really as gardeners, I think we care a lot about the earth, and anytime we use our resources, whether it's water, leaves, instead of hauling them away, shred them up and use them as mulch, compost them, that type of thing. So looking at some practical tips that really save resources, keep them right in the garden, and save time. I'm big on saving time.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you're right, watering in the morning, and even using a timer. Now, bottom line is, if your plants are drought stressed and the only time you can water is at noon, then you water, okay? Because there are times I found myself out there because it was the only time I could, because I was on the road or traveling, and I feel like I needed to put a sign out in my yard going, yes, I know I tell you to water in the morning, but I'm in desperate situation. So whenever you can, morning's your best time. And early, 3, 4 in the morning, if you get up early, that's a good time to set out your sprinkler. Yeah, not that early.
I get up at, I'm out there about 5:30.
Okay, and that's good. So, early morning is a great time to do your watering.
It's fun to be out there at 5:30 in the morning, too, to be perfectly honest.
You know, I enjoy getting up early. The birds are out. Yeah. The garden's beautiful. You get a different perspective. A little quieter out there.
I would do it every day if I, you know, I understand you're not supposed to do
it
every day.
Divide your yard up that way. So do part of it.
Oh, that would be a good idea.
And then you spread the workload out. You don't take as long. Mm-hmm. You do a good soaking in one area, then you set it out in another area. And so, you know, you can end up watering every day, but different parts of your landscape.
Yeah, that's true. I hadn't thought about that. But we have about, 15 or so potted plants that
well, those
much...
need to be, you need to be out there every day then.
Yeah, got to be out there for those anyway. So usually the, you know.
That watering wand just hits a few other things. Okay, we got to work on that, Larry.
Oh, boy. Ruth in McHenry, Illinois, it's your turn. Hi, Ruth.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm on my way back home from Minong right now, and I've been on the road for probably almost 4 hours.
Oh,
I've got
boy.
Another 4 to go. But while I was up in Spooner, we stopped at a garden center, and I bought several potted irises because I'm trying to start an iris bed. And I just wondered if I should leave them in the pots until later in the year, or if I should just go ahead and plant them now.
Oh, great time to plant. The key with planting any time during, you know, planting anything this time of year is moisture and post-transplant care. One reason I think so many people avoid summer planting is the old saying is, oh, you know, things need a lot of care and a lot of tending. And they do. They're going to need extra moisture. And if you have a bunch of plants to go out, it's easier to water them in a pot all together in the patio. But if you get them in the ground, that gives them a chance to get the root system started. Water, check those new plantings every day. You may not water every day. And then gradually, you know, extend that period between mulching is a great idea. Plant and mulch right away. It conserves moisture, reduces weed problems, and it really helps improve the soil. So those potted iris, now if they're Siberian iris, yeah, those are treated more like perennials than your typical rhizomaceous iris that we see the rhizome right at the soil surface. But yeah, go ahead. If they're potted, they're growing in containers, they're ready to go in the ground. If you're on a crazy schedule and it's easier to keep them alive in a pot until a couple months later, that's fine too. Just get them in the ground by October 1st if at all possible.
Yeah, you might even avoid the next few days. It's supposed to be 90.
Good point.
90 plus, I think, over a lot of the state the next couple of days. So
good point.
You might want to wait for at least a few days.
It's a good day to sit in the shade with a glass of lemonade and look at your garden.
Thanks, Ruth. Thanks for calling. Marilyn in South Range, your turn. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi.
Hi, Marilyn. How can we help?
Well, thank you. I have a question about rhubarb. I started growing rhubarb, and I'm terribly a novice. When's the best time to divide it? Because I missed the early part.
Right. The best time is really in spring as it's starting to come up to dig and divide it. I answered this question in my column a couple weeks ago, and somebody said, well, I don't want to wait that long. Well, I've divided rhubarb at this time of year, and it really struggles. Those big leaves lose a lot of moisture.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, people often dig and divide in fall, but then we're going into the winter season. So if you can wait till next spring, your plants will be better off. It'll be less work for you. You know, sometimes we have to move plants when we have to move plants because of an addition or we're moving or whatever. You can make sure they receive plenty of moisture, not too much, but water thoroughly. Check every couple of days. Make sure that root ball, that area is nice and moist and mulch. But if you can wait till next spring, you're going to have much better luck with the plant. It's going to be easier on the plant and easier on you as you dig and divide.
So how early in the spring could you?
We usually start checking.
North.
Pardon me?
If this is in the north.
Okay.
Superior.
Start checking around the end of April. Okay, that's usually mid-April is when we really start thinking about planting rhubarb and asparagus. Just look for those leaves breaking through the soil, and that's mainly so you can find them.
Mm-hmm.
And then as soon as you're starting to see some growth come out, you can dig and divide. So as soon as you can work the soil and you see some signs of life, that's a great time to dig and divide your rhubarb.
Okay,
thanks for the call, and good luck with that, Marilyn.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Marilyn. Melinda Meyer is our guest today, a certified arborist, TV host, author, and gardening expert extraordinaire. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Visiting today with Melinda Myers on this edition of Garden Talk, I'm Larry Mueller, and our next caller is Chad in Greenleaf. Hi, Chad.
Hello there. Hi, Melinda. It's great to speak with you.
You too, Chad.
Every spring, once the weather starts getting warm, I have a problem with June bugs in my garden eating my vegetation and even like on my cherry tree and apple tree. And I was just wondering, is there any way to combat them?
Okay, and you're sure they're those big, plump, crunchy bugs that go towards the light? And
Yep. Those are the ones. I've talked with other people. Okay. Nobody's ever heard of June bugs eating vegetation like that, but they sure like my garden.
Okay. Well, that's exactly what I was thinking. Maybe there's something else that's feeding on them. And they're truly beetles, so they do eat things. And usually what we worry about with June bugs, or some people call May beetles or June beetles, is the larvae that feed on the roots of plants, the little grubs, and, you know.
Do they like potatoes?
Well, they may be that. You may have some wireworms feeding on your potatoes and some other things. So if you're...
In fall, I'll have grubs that burrow into my potatoes, too. So I was wondering if that was a June bug's larva.
Well, and you do. There are several different kind of grubs, and the funny part is, and I feel like I'm treading into Phil Pelletieri's area here, but you have to look at the way the hairs are arranged on their back end, which I just think is hysterical because I can't even see the hairs, let alone seeing how they're arranged. But that's a good chance. If you're seeing grubs, they're coming from a beetle, and there's those are possibly the ones that are doing the damage. Hand picking is an option. Using something, again, I always like to, especially in a food garden, take something that's a little more environmentally friendly. So looking for, there's some new products that are like pyola oils that use some plant-derived oils that kind of suffocate the beetles. Neem, and as I mentioned before, neem, N-E-E-M, may provide some relief. If you want to step it up, the permethrins, but read and follow label directions, especially when your garden is flowering. You know, I heard a great program on honeybees on NPR not too long ago, mm-hmm. and they were talking about the concern with the honeybees and the population, which I've always tried to be environmentally friendly, but it just made me go, I really want to step it up a notch mm-hmm. and really try to be as careful as I can. Hand picking. I know that they kind of can pinch a little bit, and they're a little annoying.
I do that right now.
Okay.
And I can kill like 50, 60 of them a night.
Yeah. And then there's 50 or 60 more, right? Yeah, it's like, exactly. Oh my goodness, unbelievable. But yeah, so it's hand picking. I don't know of any trapping that really works with those. I don't know if you've and Phil have talked about that, Larry. Again, trying some of the more environmentally friendly products that are labeled for use on those might give you some relief. I heard some young gardeners' voices in the background, so maybe as they get older, you could all go on June bug hunts together and try to keep the populations down. A good thing is insect populations, and I know that's hard to keep in mind now as you're collecting 50 and 60 a day, is as the population of the bad guys increases, some of the parasite, some of the predaceous insects and things, their population increases. So in a few years, pretty soon they've knocked down the bad guys population and we don't see much of a problem. And then it starts all over and cycles again. Hot, dry weather is good for a lot of our insects in the milder winter. So unfortunately, I don't have anything that's going to be a cure-all quickly. So continue the hand picking, look for some of those more natural products out there. And if you do want to go to something a little stronger, the permethrins, P-E-R-M-E-T-H-R-I-N, are fairly low toxicity. Just read and follow label directions with any product you use. Try to spot treat to avoid the bees, you know, keep them away from flowers so that you minimize the negative impact on your garden and the honeybees.
All right. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you much.
Good luck. And if I find out anything, I'm going to call Larry. I'm going to do a little research on this. I'll call Larry and he can let you know.
Thanks, Chad. Nick in Green Bay. Hi.
Hi. I'm a dumb guy.
Okay. And, well, that keeps me employed. Thanks, Nick.
Sure. No problem. And whoever lived at my duplex before, they put this ugly looking like evergreen bush in there, and I don't know how to prune it, so I'm just going to remove it.
Okay.
But I want to put something like, you know, real pretty and all that good stuff in there.
Okay.
I'm thinking of a lilac bush, but I didn't know how to, like, if you just go and buy a bush and put it in there. I'm just looking for something to make it look nice. It's that ugly-looking evergreen thing.
Is it sunny out there? You got a sunny location?
Yeah, it's got a really sunny location.
Okay, great, because that's what Larry was thinking. Lilacs really need good, bright sunlight to flower. You might want to look at one of the Asiatic types, like the Miss Kim, because sometimes lilacs get very big. And the Asiatic types stay around the 4 to 5 foot. They can get a little bigger, but don't need quite as much pruning, don't have the disease problems. You may also want to look for things that, I love lilacs. They're one of my favorites. But one reason I don't have lilacs, and I have one weeping lilac in my yard, is because I have a small space. And they, once they're done blooming, that's it. And so you may want to look for something that provides four seasons of interest. Now, you're in Green Bay?
Green Bay.
Green Bay?
Yeah.
You know, there's some nice things that provide some four-season interest. The Dark Horse Weigela has purple foliage, hot pink flowers, if you like purple and pink. Okay, sorry. Yeah, after I said that, I was like, probably hot pink wasn't his favorite choice there.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, looking for things like that. Fothergilla, if it's a protected protected spot. I've seen them up in the Green Bay area, have fragrant white flowers in the spring, beautiful fall color. They're a relative of the witch hazel, and the compact variety stays a little small, like 4 to 5 feet tall. Viburnums are nice. Now, we're having problems with viburnum borer. Not so much in your area as much as in the southern part of the state. One of my favorites is Jedi or Korean spice viburnum. Nice fragrant flowers in the spring. Great fall color. Nice plant. Again, a compact one's going to stay a bit smaller. Arrowwood viburnum is a more upright grower. Great blue fruit that the birds love. Not so, they smell. They have smelly flowers in the spring, so that tells you don't open your windows. But a creamy flower, they won't, it's not sickeningly fragrant or smelly, but it's just not one like your lilacs. But they have flowers in the spring, fruit the birds love in the summer, and then great fall color. And they're kind of more upright. And a nursery right now, look for garden centers that have good fresh stock. Most of the better garden centers are getting new plants in throughout the summer. One of the reasons... Oh, go ahead.
Is it too early to plant something like that? Or
no, I would definitely heed Larry's warning about maybe not this weekend. You might want to buy this weekend, but wait till the heat passes. Easier for you, too. But if you're planting summer into fall, fall's a great time to plant also. If you plant in the summer, you're just going to have to keep after it a little more. It sounds like you have to get... You have to get that evergreen out first, so that's going to take a little.
How hard is that? Is that pretty hard?
If it's an established plant, you may need a good shovel, a bow saw, or a lot of people take a chain and a pickup truck and yank that baby out. So
I don't think the landlord would be very effective with the grass.
So you know what you'll do? Just get a good shovel and a bow saw, and as you dig, keep cutting that root system. Then what you might want to do is backfill with soil and let it settle over the rest of the summer, and then plant this fall.
Okay.
Good idea.
Okay.
Thanks, Nick.
And you're not a dumb guy. Those are good questions everyone benefited from.
Very good questions. Thanks, Nick. Stephanie and Beloit, your turn now. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi there, Larry and Melinda.
Hi, Stephanie.
I was lucky enough to take a shrubs class from Melinda at Rotary Gardens last fall.
Wasn't that, that was such a fun, I had so much fun with that class traveling around the state. So it's good to hear from you, Stephanie.
Well, I have a clematis that I started from seed called Radar Love. I believe it's a fall blooming.
Okay.
I've had three seasons with it. The year that I planted the seed, I didn't expect anything. The next year, it never bloomed. The next year, I have one bloom. I have one in a pot and one against the house, and in reading the books about it, it looked like it might be this tarnished plant bug or a ligus bug, and I wondered if because it sort of distorts the tips of the foliage a little bit.
Okay. And that's very typical of what plant bugs will do. If you're not seeing aphid damage, again, aphids will hit anything, but the tarnished plant bug will also do
anything on it. It is like there's never any critter there.
Okay. One of the things is, again, with the plant bugs, one of the good things is I can recommend that I don't feel bad about is hit it with insecticidal soap, and that's going to take care of any kind of soft-bodied insect, including plant bugs. Okay. One of the things I find with phlox, we'll often get plant bugs too, and you don't ever see them, but you'll see perfectly round spots on phlox that get the phlox plant bug. And with tarnished plant bugs, you'll often get some discoloration on the plant, but it's hard to find the bug itself. So you might want to try just hitting it with a little insecticidal soap, and a couple of good rains will definitely help us reduce the problem, you know, with many of our insects if we get a couple of good showers coming through. But I'd give it a shot, and it sounds like you're right. With the plant bugs, you often don't see them. And I always laugh when people bring me baggies of things and they'll go, I looked and I can't find an insect. And it's always, sure enough, I open the bag and one crawls up my arm, you know? And it's, and they look at me and go, really? And I'm like, I understand. It's like going to the doctor, the car mechanic, you know? The noise and the aches go away. So don't feel bad if you can't find them.
Okay. Well, I'll try that. Thank you.
Right. Thank you for calling in.
Thanks, Stephanie. Darwin in Milwaukee, your turn now. Hi, Darwin.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Melinda. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Pretty good. Well, you had a guy who called himself the dumb guy. Now you have a guy who's calling himself the scared guy.
Okay.
I have a couple of questions. One is about repotting rhododendron. I actually have had rhododendron now for 3 years, and they've survived beautifully in pots, but I've noticed this year that there's dieback because it's time. Obviously, they need to be repotted. I don't know how to do it, when to do it. Is it too late to do it now in the season? They need to be cut back. because, as I said, there's some dieback, and I'm not sure how to go about it.
Okay, all really good questions. First of all, pat yourself on the back, because keeping rhododendrons alive in a pot in Wisconsin is great.
Well,
now, do you bury the pot for the winter? Do you move the pot in an unheated garage or just leave it out in the open?
I have just left them out.
Okay, and I'm not, and I always hate to talk to people like this, because then I give them advice, and then I'm always worried, now it'll die. This would be a fine time to transplant. We've still got a good chunk of the season ahead, so it'll give them plenty of time to get reestablished.
Right.
Typically, we always want to put them in huge containers, but right. You also have to manage that pot.
Right.
So you want to make sure that it has drainage holes. You know, go to the next size, no more than two sizes bigger, really, if you want to keep it under control.
Right.
And, try to match up the potting mix you had before. It just is easier for you.
Right.
When you take it out of the container, and you probably know this, but just in case for any of our other beginning gardeners that might want to give it a try, when we take something out of a container, whether we've bought it at the nursery or we've grown it like you have, often they'll have girdling roots or circling
right.
roots.
Mm-hmm.
And if you see those, loosen those up so the okay. roots expand into the soil beyond. So you're going to probably need some help getting it out of that container. You know, try to slide it out if you need to. Use a shovel or, you know, I have this great, I think it's called a hori hori knife, and it's this wonderful mm-hmm. weed knife that I can use to slice on the inside of the pot
mm-hmm.
or anything to help separate it from the container so you can slide it out versus yank it out of the pot.
Okay.
Loosen any of those circling roots.
Right.
And then put it in its new container. And then that's a great way to get it started
great.
For the season. Then just prune off the dead growth. Most of our spring blooming plants are already starting to set bud for next spring's bloom.
Right.
So you're just going to do minor shaping, remove the dead stuff. You know, when you're starting to see those terminal buds form, leave those intact anywhere you want to have flowers.
Okay, one other quick question. Something about the soil. Does it require anything specific, the type of soil that I put in for the repotting?
One of the nice things is with doing rhododendrons in containers, they like moist, well-drained, acidic soils, which most of us don't have.
Exactly.
So you can do that by using a good potting mix. When I did my research on above-ground planters, I just, you know, when you do your research on something you can use in your life, you always have to tell somebody.
Right.
So I like things that had a little bit of real soil in them, but it's kind of hard to find that. And finding what works for you is great. A lot of the new soilless mixes are great, much better than they were even 5 or 10 years ago. Sometimes they'll be aimed for trees and shrubs, so they are a little bit heavier and don't dry out as quickly. Some are just potting mixes that are suitable for anything. The key is, the reason I'm saying matching, if you have it in a very light soil now, using a similar soil, you'll be watering the same, so you won't have that change from one to the other. So really, any container mix for outdoor plants will work. Yeah.
Good
and
luck.
Then using acidifying fertilizers, slow release, will also help. But no more after August 1st, you know. Once you transplant,
don't do that.
No fertilizing, because then you will be calling me. It'll stimulate late season growth that'll die.
Melinda Myers, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. And we're going to take some calls now. If you want to join us, by the way, the number to call, 1-800-642-1234. In Madison at 263-1890, Jenny and Tomahawk. Your turn. Hi, Jenny.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
I have questions. I'll try to phrase them so she can just say yes or no.
I don't know if I can do that, but I'll try.
Well, you know, so somebody else can get on.
Okay.
I want to ask about my iris. I need to move some because they are getting too full where they are.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to put something else in a place where they are. Now, I want to know if I take them out now, do I have to replant them right away, or can I let them kind of dry and plant them in August? And I also want to know if when I can cut the leaves back down like a fan shape.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good questions, and I'll do quickly. Yes, 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 no. Okay, here's what you can do. I'm a big believer in the longer we have things with green leaves growing, they're putting energy back into the rhizomes. And yes, you can buy iris that are all dried up and, you know, they've done exactly what you're saying. I prefer, if I have to move them, is dig them up. I'd put them in a pot or a flat or a shallow bowl kind of container, water them, keep them going, and then transplant them into their permanent space. If you don't have that new spot repaired, you know, that's a good way of holding them over. And that way they're still growing, putting energy back in. So that's one thing to do.
Oh, well.
Yeah. Cutting them back. Really, we cut our leaves back if they're unsightly. We don't do that unless we have to. The old practice with transplanting was, you know, cutting back the leaves to 4 to 6 inches because the idea is we've reduced the root system, reduced moisture loss. Again, the more leaves, the more energy that's put back in. But if you feel it's easier to manage or it's neater and tidier, at the time of digging and dividing, you can trim them up. I have some iris that I trim back because the leaves aren't that great looking. They're a little floppy and unsightly. But most of my iris, I have them tucked in with other plants that support them, and I leave them stand until fall when I do a good cleanup to prevent iris borer.
Oh, well, thank you for that information.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I have a question about weed prevent.
Okay.
Now, can I, does that keep the weeds from coming up from roots from seeds?
What is weed prevent? Do you know?
What do I do when I want to put something where I put the weed prevent?
Okay. Is it, are you talking about the...
And then put it on or what?
Okay, you're talking about one of the chemicals that's supposed to... Weed preventers, probably like a Preen or an Amaze maybe.
Okay, gotcha.
Okay. With those, always check the label. They prevent the seeds from germinating. So if you've got quack grass and you take the tops off, or if you don't have, if you didn't take the top, they are not going to kill the rhizome underneath. They're not going to kill the roots of dandelions. They're only going to prevent some weed seeds from germinating. So timing is an issue. And then also some plants can be harmed at certain stages. Like I think it's Pachysandra needs to be established before you can use it. So one of the best things to do, and I, you know what I find is I always have my reading glasses with me when I go to the garden center because those labels, the print is really tiny. But on the back of most labels, there's almost kind of a lift here and you unroll it and there's a lot of good information in there. And even when I'm recommending it, and as much as I work with plants, I always check the labels because formulations change, regulations change, and I don't trust my memory if I don't look at the label. So one of the things to do is you typically... you put it on after planting or around existing plants. You can't seed because it can't tell the difference between the good seeds and the weed seeds. And then again, some plants need to be established before you can use it. So you want to check the label before you do it. And just kind of a word out there, Preen, which is one of the more common weed preventers, that's kind of their brand name. And now they've got a total vegetation killer under the name of Preen, a broadleaf weed killer under the name of Preen,
so be careful.
A pre-emergent under the name of Preen, and a corn gluten, so more environmentally friendly weed preventer under the name of Preen. And the one thing that just made me nervous is I know as gardeners, you go, oh, Preen, and you pick up the bottle, check the label because there's different formulations under that same name. So just check, you know, check the label. It'll have all the information that you need.
Okay, well, thank you for that. And another thing, I have a lilac called Kim.
Okay, Miss Kim.
And it bloomed the very first year, one bloom only, but it did bloom. And the next year, I think it had three. And last year, it was full of blooms, just beautiful. This year, it only had one. Now, what's the matter?
I'm really glad you brought it up because we saw some really interesting responses to that weather we had this winter. It was different than I would have predicted. This is why I don't do the gamble or do the lottery. But what happened with many cases is a lot of our plants in those warm spells we had, some buds broke. And we even saw some flower buds starting to open. Then it got really cold. So my guess is it could have been some damage from that really fluctuating temperature. The other thing with any flowering shrub is don't overdo the fertilizer. We tend to think more is better, but if we over-fertilize, we stimulate lots of good leaf and stem growth, and we interfere with flowering. So chances are, if you haven't been fertilizing a lot, it was the weather. If you have been fertilizing a lot,
cut
you know
back.
What? Yes, cut back.
Thanks, Jenny. Thank you very much for calling. Leanne in Heartland, it's your turn now. Hi, Leanne.
Hi, Larry.
Hi, Hi, Leanne.
Hi, Melinda. I'm looking forward to seeing you at State Fair.
Well, good. Thank you. Stop by and be sure to remind me and say hello. So
I will. I'll be with Doris.
Oh, okay. I wondered if you were that, Leanne. So good.
I just wanted to tell people about our new gardens at State Fair that I hope they come and visit. The butterfly garden has been extended. There's going to be a neighboring garden in full. The shade garden is being worked on. And the rain garden is 3 years old now, so it's just beautiful. And we got rid of all the buckthorn.
Yeah.
And I remember getting the email on that. Sorry, I was cheering for you all. Leanne's one of the wonderful master gardeners from the Southeast Wisconsin Master Gardeners, and they work with DNR, and they have wonderful gardens on display. And so I don't know about you, but that's my one of my traditions is always to go through the DNR exhibit and visit visit my friends. So come see me at We Energy Park, then go visit Leanne and Doris and all the other wonderful master gardeners. They've got great things on display, answer questions, good information, and then go into the DNR building because they have good things on invasive species. I know you have a lot of the DNR folks on, emerald ash borer. So all those hot problems, they've got usually good samples. So thanks for the plug, Leanne, because the Master Gardeners do a great job with UW Extension. And so stop by and see their handiwork and pick up some good helpful information as well.
And let's see, the dates on the fair this year are August...
Is it
the 12th?
Okay, good. I was going, it's that Thursday around August 1st. So August 2nd. So thank you. That's good. You called prepared for me. Thanks.
Thanks, Leanne. Thanks a lot for calling. 2nd through the 12th. Oh, I never miss an opportunity to get to State Fair, and you're right. Those are great places to visit at the fair.
And the Ag Building, of course, so you can taste a little the handiwork of our Ag community.
Taste a lot. Leslie in Appleton, hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question about prickly pears that are native to Wisconsin.
Right.
I have one in front of my house. And I didn't know it was there. I bought the house in winter, and then in spring it was a nice surprise. And I added cactus soil to where it was growing because I figured it's a cactus.
Right.
And the first year I only had about 5 flowers. And last year was the 2nd year, and I had about 10 to 15. This year I had almost 30 flowers. And it's taking over where I have it.
You're doing a little really too good of a job.
I mean, it was a great surprise. I mean, I grow cactus. I have them all over my house. And I just love it. And I'd like to, like, propagate it, but I don't know where to put it. And I thought, well, maybe I'd like a different kind of prickly pear because somebody said there's, like, 5 that are native to Wisconsin.
Right. And I'm going to plead ignorance on the exact species. Mm-hmm. So if you have patience, you can email me. The other thing is check out the Wisconsin Hardy Cacti and Succulent Society. And I do think they might have a website. And they actually, they have a garden right next to the Master Gardener exhibit at State Fair. And I know I have it in my file. So if you email me at melindamyers.com and then just put a remember in big print so that I'll try to move you to the top of the list with all the other people waiting for answers. And I will post it on my website so others that are looking.
Oh, great.
So that you just go to Ask Melinda and then I'll be sure to post that. And then if I get an answer to the June beetles, not only will I let Larry know, but I'll post that too. I think I'm going to give Phil a call on my way home. So I check out the Hardy Cacti Society. I'll also try to post a few plants that I have that they suggest too, so that you can maybe develop a wonderful cacti garden in your backyard. It is a fun thing to do. So good job. You obviously have the touch.
Well, I really love that plant, and I'd like to have maybe some others, but my lawn and garden are all very shady, so it's in like the only spot that gets a lot of sun.
Okay. Yeah. And if for those of you that really want to find out more about native plants, The Vegetation of Wisconsin, not an easy read, but a good reference book by Curtis, C-U-R-T-I-S, is also a great resource for those of you looking for what was native in our state. So,
you know, we have a cactus at home, and I'm forgetting the name now, but anyway, it was inside the house.
Okay.
And it was up about 15 feet. And so with our remodeling, I had to whack it off to get it into the room that wasn't being remodeled. So I whacked it off, and we set the top part, which had 4 stalks growing up. And that was in April. And then we let those sit for about a month, and then I put those in a pot, and now they're growing. But now the cactus that I whacked off, that part that was whacked off, has grown four new, and it's now within an inch of the top of the ceiling in that room. So either we've got to get this remodeling done, or the cactus is going to have to move or something.
Or you're going to need a new room in the remodeling for the cacti and succulents. And, you know, and I know there are people cringing going, whacking it off. Because when you first make that big cut on one of those big cacti, it's like, oh, that cactus plant. You're like, oh, I've killed it. But listen to Larry's, you know, experience, because it's amazing how they do recover and continue to grow.
And we let the other piece lay for a couple of weeks.
And you really
you're
are
supposed to.
Right.
Yeah.
But that's another hard thing for gardeners to do. You kind of have to put them where you won't think about them, but won't totally forget. So you don't try to give them too much TLC. Good job.
All right. Let's go to Dwayne in Chippewa Falls. Hi, Dwayne.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Hi, Dwayne.
I have three high bush blueberry, four high bush blueberry plants. Three of them are very dark green, excellent looking. One of them is kind of stunted, has yellowish to reddish leaves. And I've done the same to every one of them, and I don't know why the one isn't responding.
You know, you bring up a really good point. And I think one of the big frustrations when I talk to gardeners and they'll have a row of something and one plant out of all of them isn't doing well. And as you work your garden, you know that there's sometimes a big difference in the soil from one plant to the next. I have a small city lot and it's just amazing to me some of the treasures I uncover from this old house. But then also just the difference in the soil in the different areas. So could be blueberries, as you know, like moist, well-drained soils, and they like acid soils. Now, if there's anything leaching from the house, you know, we use so many lime-based materials for building and for our roads and walks. And sometimes you can even, you know, in some of the research that's been done at Morton Arboretum and other places, you can actually see where the leaching has occurred on those acid-loving plants, where the one where it's exposed to that is much more chlorotic than the plant right next to it. So you might want to take a look around. Is there something like that happening? Is the drainage the same?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the top
few inches
underneath.
Is there a big rock 6 inches down?
I can tell you've been doing Garden Talk for a long time, Larry. And he's exactly right. Is there an old I've gone to properties where people will have dead grass in a perfect square and will dig down, and there was an old walk there that they, you know, covered up. So it might be doing a little research to see if there's something going on in that particular spot that's different than the others.
Yeah, all of them are in little raised beds.
Okay.
Within, oh, say, 5 feet of a pond.
Okay.
But they're roughly, say, 18 to 20 inches above the water line.
Okay.
And it's fairly loose, rocky soil.
Right.
Which I mix some decent mulch, everything on the, you know, raised bed area, and this way they could go down 18 inches and they'd be hitting water.
Okay. Do you know what your pH is in your garden by any chance?
It was, I know the one test I took in the first one, I think was about 5.
Ooh, that would be very acid. And I know Chippewa is a little more acidic than we're used to. So you may want to go to the UW Extension Soil Testing Lab. Some of those home kits are not always calibrated as precisely, and that may give you a clue. You may just want to lift that one plant out and see what's going on with the roots and see what's happening beneath. I know you hate to do that, but it sounds like you've done everything you can to treat it right. And before you fertilize, I definitely get a soil test. And then you might want to dig it out and see. You know, maybe that spot collects water more. Maybe it's a little closer to the groundwater and is staying wet longer. Maybe it drains a little better, is drying out a little bit more. You know, or dig down if you don't want to dig it out and try to check the soil, or take a probe or a pipe and pull up the soil a foot down and what's happening there. Is it staying wet longer? Is it drying out faster? And try to start there. But it sounds like it's an underground issue. And with blueberries, it's really usually a cultural problem because they're so picky in their growing conditions. So give
good
those
luck.
Yeah, do a little detective work. I'm afraid I'm sending you out with some work to do.
Thanks to Wade. Sandra and Racine, your turn. Hi, Sandy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Peas and cucumbers. My peas are, you know, we picked peas and they seem fine, but I noticed something's nipping off ends of them, of the stalk, like, or not the
of
thick
the plant.
One, but I know rabbits can't get up that tall, and we don't see deer here very often.
Your rabbits can reach pretty high. I've seen them reach up 3 feet or so. Or your peas are more like 5 or 6 feet?
Yeah,
okay.
They're higher than 3 feet.
Okay. Birds often?
Oh, that we thought maybe birds.
Yeah, and so netting, I know it's not always the most convenient. Maybe your crop's at the point where you don't mind, but birds, I've had people call me and they were describing the damage and they're looking at their plant and then all of a sudden they'll see the birds coming out and they're like, well, I think I figured it out now, Melinda. The birds came in and that's very likely.
It didn't seem to harm them that much, but maybe they would even be better
if they've done a little pruning for you, right?
Oh.
So yeah, so if you're getting a good harvest, you might decide that you'll share a little bit with the birds as long as the production is good.
They're not really eating the peas; they're just eating
the shoots. Yeah.
Yeah,
and then your cucumbers.
Well, I think it's that yellow striped bug that eats.
Oh, the cucumber beetle.
Cucumber beetles.
Are they not soft? Are they? So the insecticidal soap.
You could try it. It might discourage them somewhat, but you're right. Usually you've got to step it up a bit. You might try the neem because it takes a little broader control of a little more insects. And again, they're usually right in the flowers where your bees are going to pollinate. And so that's one of the reasons I'm always hesitant to use too much of anything.
Yeah, we don't want the bees.
Yeah, you might try the soap and just see if that's going to discourage them. You might, you know.
The garlic and hot mixtures?
That's a good question. There's that hot pepper mix that is out for insects, and you might give it a try. You have nothing really to lose at that point, and it's safe for you, so you don't have to worry. So, yeah, I totally forgot about the hot pepper spray. There's commercially available ones, and then you obviously have the recipe for doing it yourself as well.
Mm-hmm. So rhodenone is harmful to bees.
Well, it's an insecticide. It's a plant derived, so it's one that more of the organic growers tend to use. It's gentler on bees than, say, 7. It'll still kill bees, though.
I don't want to use 7 in my garden.
Yeah, and I would I'd try the soaps. I would try the neem. But rhodenone, anything that's going to kill usually beetles will also take care of your bees. So,
now, what did you say we had to be careful about the neem with?
It's NEEM. Just kind of read and follow label directions carefully. But soap's probably your safest bet. Hand picking is another safe bet.
Okay. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. And Gail in Lake Nabagamon, your turn. Hi, Gail.
Hi. I have a question. I've got a perennial garden, and I'm considering using pebbles for mulch over the landscape fabric.
Okay.
Is that a good idea or not?
Well, I'm going to have to tell you my bias right away, so you'll take my recommendation, understanding where I'm coming from. I'm not a big fan of weed barrier, and here's why. Our soils typically are not the best, and if we put weed barrier over top of them, all the good stuff doesn't get into the soil below to continually improve it. With perennials, part of what we want to have happen is for them to grow and spread and seed, and so with the fabric, it really doesn't allow for that. Now, if you're going to use stone, then you want weed barrier because weed barrier will keep the stone from going down. If you're going to use wood chip mulch, here's the problem. If you put wood chips on weed barrier, the wood chips break down, you get compost. And what I'm seeing now is people continually putting wood chips on, and then you've got 8 to 10 inches of composted wood chips.
And then you've got more weeds.
Exactly. Yeah, weeds growing in. And then I also find people who sell their house, someone who buys it, doesn't realize there's weed barrier plants in the composted wood chips. And they come and say, my plants aren't doing well. I sent them out with the shovel, and there's the weed barrier with all this great stuff above the weed barrier. So, so if you're going to use stone, you definitely want to put something underneath it. With perennials, that's such a changing garden, and you're digging and dividing that I find weed barrier becomes more of a hindrance than a help. And then using organic mulches continually improves the soil for you. And then if it gets in the soil, you don't have a nightmare whenever you do have to dig and divide where stones will travel into the soil below. So if I can convince you not to use weed barrier and not to use stone, but something organic, I think in the long run, you're going to be happier. But if you're going to use stone, definitely put a weed barrier underneath it.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. And Ron in Wausau, your turn. Hi, Ron.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good.
I basically redid a perennial bed in the front of my house with a southern exposure, and I had crocus bulbs up against the foundation of the house. Now, I pulled out everything, and I saved the crocus bulbs, and I redid the perennial bed. My question is, can I replant the crocus bulbs now, or do I wait until the fall of the year to redo it?
Well, since you've got them out, are they out and you've let them dry up and they're dormant?
Right.
Okay. Then I would just hold off, keep them in a cool, dark place until fall. Because if you dug them up from the ground and put them right back in, you'd be fine. But I'm worried if you've dug them up and you've had them set aside for a while, they're probably okay planting. But you know what? You'll have the best results if you keep them in a cool, dark place. I'm worried with such a drastic change in the environment that they're going to be stimulated to grow. And, you know, if you dug them up and then move that soil and all and put them down, they haven't experienced that real change. They're dormant, but they're kind of in that same environment they're going into. But since they've been dried up, which is sometimes the easiest way to manage, you know, making that kind of change, just put a note somewhere where you remember to find those crocus. That's always my problem is, oh yeah, I forgot to plant them. You know, put a note in your calendar that you want to put them in the fall when you're planting your other spring flowering bulbs and corms.
And good luck, and thank you very much for calling. Melinda, what's your website, by the way, again?
It's www.melindamyers.com.
MelindaMyers.com.
Right, so I do twice a month tips.
Got your books on there.
Got my books. And I'd like to invite all your listeners to send photos of their garden. I have a new gallery called What's Blooming, and we're trying to get people to submit photos of their garden. And if you grow sunflowers with your kids or gardeners of any age, we're trying, in the fall, I want to do a sunflower gallery to get kids with their sunflowers, kids of all ages. So I know I have a few 80-year-old kids out there submitting pictures. So check it out and visit me, and I'd love to have you be part of the Melinda Myers Garden Club, which is free and just newsletters and fun things to learn about from each other.
Thanks, Melinda. Melinda
Thank you,
Myers.
Larry.
You're listening to the Ideas Network.